With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, in the fourth and final Little Atoms special from Future Everything, Alex Fleetwood on the demise of hide and seek and a possible national game space, and then Anab Jain on Superflux.
Alex Fleetwood is the founder and director of Hide and Seek, a recently and sadly closed game design studio that was dedicated to inventing new kinds of play. Hide and Seek started life in 2007 as a festival of social games and playful experiences on London's South Bank and built into a studio occupying, let's should say, it says occupied, a unique position in the UK, creating innovative games, installations and events with a host of world-famous brands. Alex, welcome to this
Hello.
Fireside chat, first of all. Before we get into talking about hide and seek and what happened with hide and seek, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got there, actually, how you ended up in games design.
So my original background is music. I studied music at York University, which is a wonderful place to be. And I originally worked in the field of sort of opera and producing kind of artistic projects in contemporary music. So I worked for some small-scale opera companies and ran an opera competition and did sort of things like that. And was increasingly kind of aware and uncomfortable of this disconnect between this funded, subsidised, amazing art experience that I was contributing to that was for really not very many people. And everyone kind of being okay with that, you know, like it was this sort of thing that every, you know, like I remember the artistic director of a well-known North London Opera Festival saying, you know, we get our three broadsheet reviews and our audience comes from N5 and N1 and I'm fine with that. Okay, so if you're fine with that, I need to do something different because I'm really not. And at that stage, Channel 4 was broadcasting the occasional film opera back when Channel 4 did adventurous arts programming.
And long time ago.
No, cast your mind back. I thought, well, film opera is interesting. That sort of would be an exciting development. And I kind of got a job in TV and I was sort of seeing how I could maybe put these things together. And with the help of a brilliant producer called John Wyver, put together a proposal for Channel 4 for a film opera project called The Eternity Man. And that was a kind of 5-year fundraising epic, as these things tend to be. And during that time, I actually worked for Channel 4, completely coincidentally, in a kind of a commercial job, ending up running their kind of DVD acquisitions team, working with the likes of Company Pictures and those kinds of companies. So through that whole kind of process, I was on one side kind of in a big UK broadcaster, which was experiencing this great kind of convulsing panic about the internet and user-generated content, which was what everyone used to say back then, as if that was some kind of universal panacea for television. We'll just add this thing called UGC to television and then everyone will be okay. But actually, the people who worked at Channel 4 who weren't in charge but who were in the canteen having lots of discussions about games and internet and culture and all of those things, that was super interesting and really formative. At the same time as that, I'm taking this art form that I love and trying to kind of translate it into this much more distributable, accessible, populist film format, and going to lots of participatory, interactive, site-specific work, because those are all words that, you know, we're still bandying around, but they were kind of pretty hot at the time. Yeah. They kind of meant, they meant something to me at the time, and it was very exciting, and certainly in particular, the first Punch Drunk show I saw in 2005, the Firebird Ball at Oval, was one of those kind of exciting moments where this is one part warehouse party, one part video game, and one part theatre. Well, I really like all of those things. And it kind of then, it was a bizarre revelation, really. I'm like, hang on. I've been making culture for my whole life and doing all these sort of things, and that's my job and my career. At the same time as that, I've been playing video games, and I love them, and they're meaningful, and they're some of my most amazing experiences have been playing video games. But, like, video games culture and this little bridge kind of built, and I kind of went, well, why have I never thought about that as a kind of territory to explore as a producer and as a creative? Why have I always been kind of over here this stuff? And I guess it's because there is a kind of unconscious prejudice that you don't kind of associate what's going on in video games with stuff that happens with that sort of cult. There's a terrible word, isn't it? Culture. But, you know. And so I thought, well, I need to investigate that. I need to check that out. So worked a little bit with Punch Drunk. We did a kind of crazy prototype. And with their help, put on the first Hide and Seek Festival, which was a kind of in concrete, let's make some games. Let's just do something. Let's put something on. And then the reaction and the kind of response to that real-world event, you know, just seeing... It was a couple of hundred people, but their kind of intensity of their reaction to it was so amazing that I'm like, yeah, this is it. This is the place to be, so...
So we're talking very specifically about here, just in case anyone isn't clear on that, on games that, you know, participated in the world, in real life, rather than video
games. Street galleries. Well, that's where we began.
Yeah.
The sort of nucleus of Hide and Seek is this festival of games for public space, which was collaborating with artists, theatre makers, interested people to create games that people could then play on the street, in a room, wherever the game was set.
Where do you think your interest in games stayed? I mean, how did you sort of you retain that right up to that time?
We all share. I certainly some of my most extraordinary experiences have come playing games, whether it be, playing RuneQuest or Warhammer with friends as a kid, or playing the first Tomb Raider, or these kind of moments that I kind of remember really vividly and really clearly. So it wasn't that much of a... And I guess the kind of music that I'm interested in is also kind of at that edge between improvised... music, you play it, there's this sort of, there are rules, you can master it, there are qualities of improvisation and performance... There's a lot of stuff going on, and there's a complicated relationship between storytelling and music that people work out in different ways. So there were all sorts of things, I think, in my kind of makeup that found a really interesting place when I started to sort of apply them in the world of games. The first thing I did, and was is one of the reasons why it's possible for Hide and Seek to exist, is that there is a kind of secondary literature around game design now. It was this kind of slightly guarded... the people who made games didn't really talk about the way they made games. They just sort of happened.
Yeah.
And now, thanks to the likes of Eric Zimmerman and Katie Salen with Rules of Play and the Rules of Play Anthology, and Raph Costa and his Theory of Fun for Game Design, there's a lot of books out there that a kind of idiot like me can buy and read and start to kind of assemble some thinking about how games work and apply those to making things.
Where does that, I guess, not secrecy, but that sort of unclearness about the games come from then? Are we talking, is that really because of, the corporate nature of design of big blockbuster games, and has that changed with the sort of the re-rise, once upon a time when we were first into computer games, they were independently produced by people in their bedrooms.
Right.
That's starting to happen again. That's been able to sort of...
I think it's just a gradual process as a kind of cultural, a new cultural form kind of takes shape. Film studies came a long time after film.
Yeah.
The grammar gets worked out, all the sort of, the kind of rules and the tropes and the sort of things get worked out initially by artists and makers, and then gradually kind of get codified and reflected on, and they enter the academic kind of territory. And then you get, now what you've got, with the likes of sort of, Jonathan Blow is a good example. You've got a very self-conscious game designer who's referencing styles of video game in a very nuanced way in his work. So then you're kind of coming sort of full circle now, where we have these sort of second or third generation video game artists who are kind of reflecting back on historic practice in interesting ways. So
And that obviously works the game, but then people who have that knowledge can sort of appreciate that, looking back on that history.
We kind of all have that knowledge, right? We all have that knowledge as players. Like we have there's an enormous corpus of shared knowledge of types of play experience that we've had playing games, and it's not just video games. We understand how, we've all played board games, card games, parlor games. Both our learned understanding of different types of games and how they work, but also just our innate understanding of fun and fairness and all of those things. So there's a lot of material to work with that's shared.
Yeah,
it's not it's less niche than one might think.
Let's talk about some of those earlier projects then. Mm-hmm. What did you start doing? What sort of things did Hide and Seek do?
So that first festival happened, and then a kind of pre-Hide and Seek project, but that was nonetheless quite formative, was a thing called the Soho Project, where we, for the London Games Festival Fringe in 2007, we took over a base in Soho and created an early sort of Facebook, YouTube game where you had missions that you had to accomplish and you had to film yourself while accomplishing those missions and then upload the video to YouTube and tag it, and then it would be reviewed and you would score points as a result. And they were sort of missions that were intended to kind of creatively engage you with the landscape and the history of Soho. So there was, I remember one which was in the manner of the street, where you had to sort of, you know, be kingly in Kingly Court or carry a giant cigarette down Great Marlborough Street or however you wanted to sort of interpret that. And, you know, it was really, really good fun for literally ones of people. Like, you know, I think it was about seven people who really got into that. But, you know, like, it was, there was all kinds of stuff in it that, you know, Kony, so Tassos Stevens, of course, being a very established company now, very clear, you know, Tassos and I kind of collaborated on that. And you kind of, it's funny looking back at the people who made that game, like the bunch of them now live in Portland and work for Nike on Nike Plus. You know, there's all kinds of things that come out of that. So there was that. The first kind of hide and seek projects where Holly set up the sand pit, and that kind of then got set up through hide and seek. You know, she kind of came and she was involved in the Soho project and said, you know, like, I want to do this event. And I said, I think that sounds great. Shall we work on it together? And then they started to happen. The first ones were at Shunt, and yeah, we just kind of got out there and just tried to find as many interesting artists that we thought would want to make games and started to put those things together. Shunt was a brilliant place to do that. You know, had an amazing atmosphere and you could just try stuff out and really kind of go for it there. And then there was this sort of studioizing of the content. You know, we got approached quite early on by AKQA, the digital media agency. They were working on a game, an ARG, if you remember those, for Sherlock Holmes, to promote the Sherlock Holmes movie. And they needed some creative direction. This was a recurring pattern through the life of Hide and Seek, where we would go to these digital agencies and they would say, we want an ARG and a Facebook thing and a big campaign, and you'd have this brilliant deck that would have all these things in it, and there would be just no idea in it at all. There's not one kind of iota of creative. It's just like sort of saying, like a building, we're going to have a room and a different kind of a room and a staircase, and as if that somehow kind of constitutes making. So we came in and designed that. We were the kind of creative directors of that. So that kind of tipped us in a very different direction. We were taking the kind of real-world social play but trying to apply it in this very kind of grand digital context. It was a very fun early project called PlayStation Game Runners, where we worked with a group of young people to design new street games and take them through this kind of game design sort of boot camp process. You know, it's a good way to kind of get to grips with game design, making games in the real world, because you don't have any kind of... the iterative loop is very small. You know, you make a game, you give it to a person, you see whether it's fun or not, because they're either enjoying themselves or not enjoying themselves, and when they're not, or they're confused or run off in the wrong direction because you've not explained it well. It's very direct feedback, which is a very good kind.
When you're designing the games, are you able to sort of... Do you use that and sort of use that in sort of real time? Are you able to sort of see what's going on and sort of change things? Is it that curated? Or?
I think it's a really, really important part of what made Hide and Seek Hide and Seek is that at the kind of baseline for us is not technology or engineering, or it's this cultural experience of play and a kind of human shared experience where designer and player are part of the same group. You know, the kind of magic of the sandpit was, it was very, you know, there was an awful lot of very careful design that went into each one, but then the feeling of each event was much more loose and kind of free. People had brought games that they'd made to test, people would play them, give feedback, and then that whole group would go off and play something else together, and, you know, like, it didn't have the kind of, these people are the artists, and these people are the audience, and those people are separate from one another. It was much more of a, it had a much more communal feel to it.
How does that translate then into the work that you did for like bigger studios, for film work and
I think a commitment to ideas and experience over platforms and technology. Like, we get excited and geek out about the kind of potential of any new tech just as readily as the next person, but I think we always try to subordinate what that technology was doing to some kind of direct, understandable human experience that we thought people could have via the thing that we were creating. So, for example, with 221B, the Sherlock Holmes game, the very simple idea that powered that was that I'm going to play as Holmes, you're going to play as Watson, or vice versa, but we're going to get paired up through Facebook, we're going to have a little adventure every week and discover bits of evidence, and we won't be able to solve the puzzle unless we share evidence, that there's going to be things in on my evidence that contradicts things that you think, and vice versa. So forcing a one-to-one conversation that the game didn't facilitate, but that had to happen in order for you to be able to solve that puzzle. And that was a kind of very simple kind of idea, but sort of just expressed a kind of different kind of multiplayer experience that was rooted in a kind of conversation. And the game was more about the chat, really, than what was happening in the game itself.
So where did the... I mean, we're going to get up to the point in a bit where you close.
Yeah, sure. So skip to the end.
Yeah. But let's talk about where it went from those early days and the things you've already described. What was going on to the point? Basically, what are the reasons? I guess we're going to get to why it ended up closing down, but how the things that you were developing ended up
the seeds of
causing that to happen. Indeed.
Well, I mean, there was a desire that I had to. I think the kind of driving force behind most of the decisions that we took at Hide and Seek was to get better at making games and to make better games. And one of the really powerful lessons that I think we learnt is that outsourcing your game making to others is a really problematic experience. And obviously the kind of core team of Hide and Seek were not digital makers. And I think, you know, the journey that we went on parallels the journey that other cultural organisations are going on, but not as well and much slower, where they kind of try to figure out how to incorporate digital making into the structure of their organisation. And the kind of, you know, we had all of these interesting failures where we worked, you know, we sort of, there's this, I mean, it sounds sort of almost embarrassing to say it, but, you know, like you know, I wrote a game design document and I handed it over to some people and got back a thing that was not the thing that I wanted. And I'm like, and then, you know, someone had to take me aside and say, well, you know, that's because this is a Word document and that's a piece of software and these two things are not the same as each other. And, you know, like, you're going to have to kind of get to grips with that. So we did. And you get to grips with it by hiring talented developers and by hiring a technical director and gradually kind of building out the kind of capacity of the studio and the culture of the studio to include those kinds of making in it. And that's something that was really important to me. And so what comes with that is an increased overhead. And that was okay for a while. Like the kind of the sort of expanding ability of the studio to find bigger projects and earn more money. We started to add consultancy in, you know, kind of talking to big companies about gamification and all of these things that they were scratching their heads about, and that was a kind of really useful way to kind of keep the kind of cash flow turning over. And then we would sort of basically just reinvest that in badly funded cultural projects. You know, when, you know, like if you're a commercially run studio, any culturally funded project that you do is going to lose money.
And
I think, you know, people think, oh, well, it's cost neutral maybe, you know, because it's sort of, you put in an Arts Council budget and you get all that money back. It doesn't take into account what it just costs to stay alive in London. So you know. And we were committed to that, and there was nothing we could do about it, and we tried putting in budgets that reflected what it actually cost to make something, and they would always get rejected. So we're like, well, we would rather do this work than not do it, because we care about it, and it's the only place that we can do it. So we kept doing those things. So you've got this slightly odd business model for an organisation, though, where you're paying for the cultural work out of the commercial things that you do.
Is that something that affects a lot of startups and companies? We're in, I guess, quite a weird area where nobody really knows what they're doing. Everything's like new, is a new frontier. And is that something that I think a lot of small startups are coming? There's a point that it gets to where the next leap is just sort of too big, you know, almost too big to surmount.
There is no intellectual grasp of what it means for a new cultural organisation to grow and develop beyond the subsistence level. In the cultural space. You know, the rhetoric and the funding is targeted at people who can afford to do it for fun, really. Yeah. Like, it's if you're a new company and you haven't got much overhead and you haven't, you know, like, and you can work flexibly because the people who are involved in your organisation don't have too many responsibilities outside of work, or if you're a one-man, kind of one-woman freelance outfit who can mix things more straightforwardly, then working with the cultural sector can be viable. But there isn't, you know, like last year we saw Little Loud go bust. I mean, we went down, there were several other companies, all of whom were operating in this difficult middle space of been around a while, built up an impressive body of work and a studio, but there isn't the money in each individual commission to sustain that. You know, we were still right up to the end of Hide and Seek. We spent 7 years explaining to large cultural organisations that no, £3,000 is not enough to make an app of any kind, really. Like, I mean, that's not enough to put your logo on a screen and like the cost of submitting that thing to the App Store and making a binary. And so that gradually happened over time. You know, there's this process where that made sense for a while in the middle. But we also started, I mean, I know, speaking personally, this sort of other thing starts creeping in, you know, fatigue starts to creep in, you know, like this kind of holding together this slightly awkward business model. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really, you can't really see any way that it's going to get better because it's not like the, you know, I guess when I started Hide and Seek, I had this kind of optimistic view that somehow the cultural sector would sort of expand in a way to make room for games as a thing, that there would be this kind of, oh, hey, those guys are doing interesting work and it's games and it's in the cultural sector. Well, we should probably fund that in some sort of a way, and that would sort of kind of emerge, and therefore we'd be able to access that support and figure out some kind of way forward. Mm-hmm. That sort of became apparent that wasn't going to happen. We had, you know, so many, you know, we applied, I think, 9 times to the Arts Council in a row, every single one unsuccessful, and you know, asked why that was and went to see people at the Arts Council and said, you know, like, at any point will you hire someone or a team that specialise in games and that, you know, like, are a kind of, you know, like, we've got relationship managers for visual arts and literature, and they say, what about a games team? And they're like, oh, no, we'll never do that, you know. And at that point you kind of think, well, shit, like, you know, we're barking up the wrong tree here.
And also someone spending all their time writing those applications for those Arts Council grants.
We did work out that if you added up all the time we'd spent working on arts applications, like, we could have paid a whole extra person to just make games for a year. And you're like, well, yeah, that's not, like, you know.
This is obviously, I mean, it's obviously something that happens to a lot of small startup companies, but there's something particularly, I think, ironic about, you know, working for a company or having a company that's supposed to be about making fun that starts not to be fun to actually do.
Yeah, I mean, I think Hide and Seek was amazing. Like, working with the group of people that I work with at Hide and Seek was a privilege, and some incredibly, incredibly talented people that I'm very glad I got to be in a studio with for the time that I did. But certainly trying to, yeah, it's just that the kind of stress of holding something together that doesn't make any sense basically starts to tell. And it was ultimately my responsibility, you know. I mean, I led the company with a great board and Margaret Robertson and all these people who all worked hellishly hard to try to pull this thing together. But it was my thing. I started it. You feel a certain kind of personal responsibility. And when you can't hold it together anymore, that's pretty tough.
And it's quite a bold decision to actually, you know, make the decision to say we're closing this down rather than just either let it just fall apart itself naturally or pull it into hibernation and come back or something. You've actually taken the step to say, right, this is the end of this era.
Yeah. I mean, I think partly that's a reaction to, I mean, I think there are a few different things in there. Mm-hmm. I think one is the people who are involved in Hide and Seek are too talented and interesting to kind of remain kind of vaguely located under Hide and Seek in the kind of possibility that it might reemerge again. Speaking personally, I feel that Hide and Seek was started with this very optimistic idea about games as culture, and that has been disproven for this time period. So there's no, like, if it continues in any form, then people in charge at the Arts Council and places like that can sort of think that they're still, even though they're not funding us, they still think because it exists that somehow things are okay.
Yeah, sure.
So actually stopping it was kind of a, do you know, it's not okay. Mm-hmm. It's really not okay, and this thing doesn't just kind of vaguely tick a box for you. It's not here anymore. And I think also, you know, like, there's no actual, it's not a bad thing in lots of ways for a company to end. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we feel a certain kind of anxiety about it. And I know that we spent a long time kind of reflecting on it and making sure that it was the right thing to do. But I feel that Hide and Seek did some interesting work, influenced some people, and stopped when the time was right for it to stop. And there were all kinds of reasons why that happened. And it doesn't change the kind of quality of the back catalogue. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I'd rather be a band that quit when they were still good, rather than kind of cranking out tours for, you know, whatever remained of what was interesting to people for years to come.
I want to move us on to talk about actually making those conditions, the conditions you talked about, the cultural conditions that allow a company like Hide and Seek and others to flourish, to sort of change that. And I've seen elsewhere you talk about this, the idea of a national game space. So, well, tell us first of all what that concept means, and then we'll sort of look into it.
So, historically, we've been pretty good at noticing that there are new cultural forms that have meaning to lots of people and values at play within them that a publicly sort of funded institution with public service goals mm-hmm. could make good use of. So Channel 4, the BFI, the Arts Council, the National Theatre, the BBC mm-hmm. are all examples of not just, I mean, you know, very different kind of an intervention that comes directly from government that's in response to a report that tries to make a different kind of a space for culture, a different kind of culture to exist. Mm-hmm. If you look at the work of the BFI, and you know, was the UK Film Council and now is mm-hmm. the BFI again, funding, financing, exhibition, you know, distribution and access, diversity, support for new talent, distribution, archiving, there's a lot of functions that film culture needs to thrive mm-hmm. that the market on its own won't be perfect at supplying.
Sure.
You know, I think central to my sense of what a national game space is to say that I think there's a great opportunity to design a new cultural institution in 2014 that reflects where we are now. You know, this would be the first one of these that's been designed since the internet. Mm-hmm. So we have to think a lot about, well, what does the word national mean in this context when everything will be available online around the world? But I think something that takes into account the platform and the hardware that games exist on, mm-hmm. the lives of people who make games and the kind of sense of their kind of development as creative people, as artists, the way we kind of bring more people to games that are interesting and that are kind of culturally diverse, the way we bring more diverse makers into mm-hmm. a space where they are able to be supported to make games and experiment and bring new voices into that kind of world. There's a lot of things I think games culture pretty urgently needs that an institution could serve very well.
So what would it, I mean, precisely, what would it, this place look like?
What would it look like? Well, so I think there's a big fuck-off building, or maybe more than one. Like, yeah. I mean, I think, obviously, I may be guilty of some bias here, but I think that one of the gnarly challenges of game culture as it is now is that you basically access all of it online and you access it all through platforms which are owned by US mm-hmm. corporations mm-hmm. whose first interest is mostly money, not games. So the ways in which we access content is pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And that means that there's a kind of ultra nichifying of game types. If you only experience a game by seeking it out, you're probably only going to seek out the games that you already like. And that becomes a kind of, and then there's a community of interest around that. And it's quite hard to get into a new game because it takes more investment than just rocking up and watching a film. So all of those things kind of reinforce one another to make this culture feel quite atomized and disparate. And so there's no kind of place where we can say, well, actually, there's a lot of shared values to game culture that anyone can enjoy, and there's no place where that can flourish. Now, so partly I think that means that the national game space exists digitally, mm-hmm. and it creates, you know, basically what I think of as a kind of public service steam, you know, the sort of, you know, what does that kind of distribution platform look mm-hmm. like online, which when it's motivated by public service values of access, diversity, mm-hmm. cultural value, all of those sorts of things. But then I think do need to be physical instances, literal game spaces, where you can go and encounter these things in a curated environment. What does that look like? I think it maybe feels like a really amazing 21st century game arcade, mm. where you just kind of walk in and go, holy shit, like, that's a game, and that's a game, and this is also a game. And there's a theme, you know, like, so, like, you know, we're just starting to curate games based on ideas rather than these are all the games that are available on this platform, mm-hmm. or, you know, these are all the games that are about shooting. You know, that's not the most interesting way to curate. Mm-hmm. You know, what's a kind of curated series of games that are about identity, or what's a curated series of games that are about sexuality? You know, like, that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. I'd like that game season to exist. I'd like to play those games in order and then talk to my friends about them. So I think that there's obviously the kind of interesting, complicated, needs to be invented relationship between the fact that everyone walks into this device, everyone walks into this building with access to the digital platform at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you have to, I think, get a lot smarter about the relationship between the devices in our pocket and the embedded reactive technology in the infrastructure of the building. So I think there's a kind of requirement to design a new architectural infrastructure which allows a much more dynamic relationship between smartphones, tablets, other kinds of mobile device, and what's going on in the kind of skin of the building itself in terms of the things that you're encountering and playing there.
I want to sort of talk a bit more about how the whoever it was that is running this space would sort of interact, what sort of things they would do, because obviously there's the issues of having a corporate space. You've hit on it will be something that obviously there's plenty of issues that we've had to look at that come with a thing being run by a big organisation. But also, if it's run by a sort of cultural organisation in the BBC or the National Theatre style, there's a chance of it seeming a bit worthy and a bit educational and, you know, something that has that BBC-ish feel to it as well. So.
Well, again, I think that's a design challenge. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really important one. I mean, I think Channel 4 is not a bad model. The basic deal with Channel 4 is that, you know, in 1982, the government gave Channel 4 one quarter of the public attention. Because they give them the fourth channel, and that was, TV was the kind of, not the only game in town, but it was a much more dominant kind of force at that stage. And they said, you've now got this massive chunk of attention, we can give you that. You can sell advertising to make money for this thing, but in exchange for the opportunity to make money out of the advertising, you need to make programmes that fulfil these different kind of public service criteria. They have to, you know, you have to do a certain amount of history and learning and religious education, and you have to experiment. Well, the original charter says you have to experiment with the form of television and an advanced form of television. It doesn't say that anymore, but it used to. And so there's a fairly straightforward trade-off there. And, of course, you have to not make these programmes yourself, but invest in independent makers and commission them externally and only be a kind of receiving house. So I think you look at that model and you say, well, some of those things have worked brilliantly. There's now this, you know, there were no independent television production companies in the UK in 1981, and then by 1987 there were loads, and they were very interesting and diverse, and they made very different kinds of TV. Well, you know, what happens if you apply that to the independent game community? I think you amplify it, and it develops in all kinds of exciting ways. I think that you have to think really carefully about what the equivalent government way of securing that big chunk of attention is, and that's not so easy to figure out. But I would say not a bad place to start is the BBC commands a pretty fucking big chunk of attention right now, and it could point that attention in the direction of something new if it was compelled to. It would never choose to, but it might be compelled to. I mean, you know, that is kind of what's happening, or what ought to be happening with the space, right? I mean, we'll see what that turns out to be, but that's certainly the theory with the space. And, you know, when that launched in its sort of prototypical form, I was struck by the fact there were adverts on the Tube and things on iPlayer and all these things. I'm like, the BBC has big levers that it can pull to direct attention in a particular direction if it wants to. And I think that then you also have, this body has a kind of commissioning power. It's going to fund games. It's going to fund game makers over a sort of sustained period of time, potentially, so that they can experiment and make games that the market would not normally allow them to make. I think that there's then the potential for those games to be commercially tremendously successful. I think that there's a lot of appetite for games that are sophisticated, that engage us emotionally. Journey, a couple of years now, but, you know, the biggest selling game on PSN and probably the most artistically ambitious as well. And maybe those two things are not coincidental, and that money should feed back in. So, I mean, I think, you know, especially because you're probably making, you are making this argument in 2014 when the market is king. You can't just make a kind of, it can't be just based in civic aspiration. You have to make the kind of market case. But I think you can make the market case. I think you say, by funding innovation and experimentation in the field of games, and by kind of developing sophisticated, brilliant, creative, talented game makers with greater ambition and resource than they would have otherwise, you create a portfolio of games which you then sell online and that can be really commercially successful, you know, globally. That money feeds back into the core function of the organisation.
What about the audience for it as well? Is it a point of this to sort of to broaden gaming out to a wider audience? Because still, despite, you know, the absolute huge business of computer gaming specifically, gaming is still something considered like a bit of a niche activity. In fact, you know, there's a name for it, gamer,
right?
Which is weird because, you know, I love music, but no one calls me a listener. It's like,
no. Fuck that term, man. If I could do one thing with my life, it would be to lay the word gamer to rest in an unmarked grave. I mean, it's not a niche activity, right? Like, expand your definition of game playing to include board games, card games, iPhone games, Facebook games. You know, like, the data basically supports the fact that everyone is playing a game of some kind. They don't necessarily talk about it. They don't, certainly don't kind of publicise the fact. But if you press most, like, you know, there's very few people who say, I don't. I mean, because it's still a badge of honour in our kind of weird, morally panicked, game-averse culture to say, oh, I don't play games. No, I don't. And then you press somebody, and of course they do. They play something, and they get value out of it. Mm-hmm. They just hadn't kind of... You know, what they generally mean is, I don't play those awful shooty fighty games that my children play, mm-hmm. which, you know, is a different... I'm not going to get into that. But so it's already pretty broad. I think that the role... I mean, I think this is a really... I would say I do not have... I mean, all of these things are theories, right? And they all need to be tested. And I definitely don't feel like I have the answers to this. I think there is a really big question about what role... What's the positive role that subsidy plays... Mm-hmm. in a sector that's already pretty successful in market terms. You know, sure. Often subsidy exists to address market failure. And games, we don't have a very obvious market failure. I think, actually, we do, because if you look at the kind of people who tend to be making those games, they tend to occupy, you know, the sort of, you know, white male, 20 to 35, mm-hmm. can afford to take a swing at making a game for 2 or 3 years, and if it fails, hey, you know, no biggie. But, you know, leaving that aside, there's still people making games of lots of different kinds that are reaching audiences, and that's going pretty well.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I think that partly it's about, it is like, I think access is a really important thing. Like, I think basically, I think there are an awful lot of amazing games that if people just knew they existed, mm-hmm. and to a certain extent were told that they were good, you know, I think there's a thing that when the National Theatre puts on a play, it's not just the marketing that gets people to go, it's because it's at the National Theatre, and there's a kind of very powerful kind of reinforcing role, a kind of convening power that a cultural institution has. When the BFI puts on a season of work, it's putting, it's a very powerful kind of force that exists behind that, that says, no, this stuff has meaning, it has value, you should check it out. So I think, you know, bringing a bit of that in opens up new markets, new opportunities for games that already exist to reach people. I also think that you then think about commissioning in terms of what's not being fulfilled by the market. And partly that's like talking to a very talented game maker at the Game Developers Conference. And he was very clear, you know, like, the games he makes now occupy about sort of 5 to 10% of his kind of interest space, mm-hmm. as an artist. But they're the ones where his work meets the market most evidently, where he knows, if I make a roguelike, I will get people who like roguelikes to buy that game. Mm-hmm. So I'll make that, and that'll do okay, and then I can keep going. So you just, you know, subsidy immediately offers that person an opportunity to make something else from the kind of possibility space. And he's a fucking amazing game maker, so I'm pretty confident that when he did that, that thing would be successful. Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't, there's more of a safety net that kind of operates around it.
So just one more question from me, and then I'm going to open it up for some questions from the audience. So what's next now? What are you doing project-wise and business-wise now?
You know, Spittleflecked Ranter is the sort of job title for Tommy. I am, well... I'm just about to go on holiday for 2 months with my family and have a proper break, which is going to be great. Yeah, I'm going to go and stare at some mountains. I think that it's pretty likely that the next thing that I do will be a straight-up commercial project, because that's what makes sense now. Mm-hmm. I think that the talk about a national game space is great, but realistically, this is not a thing that's going to happen anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And figuring out how we get to that place, I'm committed to talking about it. I'm committed to kind of calling out what I think are the kind of weird inconsistencies of the way we fund and support culture right now. I'm committed to doing whatever I can to do that. But the thing that I will do next will probably not be directly connected with it. What that is, there's a moratorium on new ventures until I've gone and stared at some mountains, sure. And then I'm going to come back and figure out what it's going to be.
I think that seems fair enough. And actually, we've run over time, so I'm not going to take another question. So thanks for coming in. Give your appreciation to Alex Fleetwood, everybody.
I'm Alex Kratosky, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
And I'm Jane, is founder of Superflux. Born and educated in India, with an MA in interaction design from the Royal College of Art, she founded Superflux in 2009. She has led multidisciplinary design, strategy and foresight projects for businesses, think tanks and research organisations such as Sony, the BBC, Nokia, the NHS, the government of the UAE, and her work has been exhibited at MoMA New York, Apple, Mattel Toys, Tate Modern, the Science Gallery Dublin, and the London Design Museum. And before we're going to get on to talk about Superflux and some of its work and the ideas that drive it, but before we do that, can you tell me something about your background in design, your education before you got up to the founding of Superflux?
Yes, I'm from India, and I studied at the National Institute of Design in India. So it's a design school. It was founded by Charles and Ray Eames. Mm-hmm. There's a big tradition of that sort of thinking. It's a multidisciplinary design school, so there's a bit of Bauhaus design influence on the school. I ended up studying filmmaking, actually. So in my previous life, I used to be a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I used to make documentary films and produce documentary films. And I had another company doing that work. But I kind of always had one foot in design, and I found the film industry in India extremely frustrating and difficult to work in unless you are working in Bollywood, which mm-hmm. I wasn't keen to. And so I actually applied for communication design at the RCA, and then just a day before I was supposed to send the application, I changed it to interaction design, and I think that was the best decision I made, because I really enjoyed the course. I think it changed my life. Mm-hmm. I think about design in very different ways, and I'm able to use my skills in filmmaking as well. So in a way, it's been a long journey to come to a point where I feel I'm not so worried about defining things and defining boundaries around disciplines mm-hmm. or design, but it's just kind of you live with it as a field. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about career-wise then, up to the point of design-wise, up to the point of Superflux?
So like I said, I did my MA at the RCA, mm-hmm. and then I was working at the RCA's Helen Hamlin Centre for Design. I was doing a project around future of work for a year, and then worked for a couple of years at the Microsoft Research in Cambridge, and then at Nokia. But I kind of always wanted to do things which were not looking at just one kind of technology. So with Nokia, it's mobile phones. But at Microsoft, we were thinking about machine intelligence mm-hmm. and robots. And I think as soon as I got the visa to be a freelancer, I started Superflux, really. Mm-hmm.
Just before we get on to Superflux, I want to talk about some of the people or things or designs that have been an influence on you.
Yeah.
And interestingly, I'm reading other interviews with you,
yeah.
Inevitably a lot of film imagery comes
yes.
up.
Yeah. I mean, so NID is a fabulous school for learning film, and even though it's National Institute of Design, we had the most prolific film club, we were seeing films from Bresson and Godard and Antonioni every day. Mm-hmm. It was an approach to the world. It was an approach to the world which was inviting the audience to participate in the narrative, participate in the story, and that sort of engagement is perhaps one of the biggest influences in my work in design, that you're not just presenting, but you are requesting a certain kind of a dialogue, or you are allowing people the opportunity to form their own opinions, mm-hmm. Or question their opinions. So, yes.
And I particularly wanted to talk about Donna Haraway as well, who's someone who's a big hero of yours.
Yes, I mean, Catherine Hales and Donna Haraway, to me, are true technologists, even though they would never call themselves that, in a sense, that Donna Haraway, the way she framed her thinking through the manifestos mm-hmm. that she's written, talking about cyborgs and feminism, are a huge influence, because she talks about intelligent machines and she talks about the idea of intelligence, but it is very much about humanity and what it means to be human. And so every time any of the work we do around technology, that question is always there at the back of our minds. What mm-hmm. What does it mean to be human? Increasingly more so.
Superflux, then, what is it? What does it do? What are its preoccupations, shall we say? What's the sort of philosophy behind it?
I think I started off Superflux very much as a hobby, to be honest, to say that I just want to do work that is of interest. But of course, my partner, John Arden, who also joined me, he also graduated from the RCA Design Interactions, and he also has a background in interaction design and worked with other companies before, came on board, and we decided to actually make it a business. Mm-hmm. So that was a big change, shift from with John's coming on board, and together we want this to be a business, but we want it to be a business which is economically sustainable, but also can think. Because, like, a lot of design studios, like large design studios or large organizations like Microsoft, where I work, have research labs.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't design studios have research labs? Mm-hmm. And quite often, we still have a tiny room, but we used to have an even smaller space to work in. And we would invite people to come, and they'd go, "So where's the lab?" And the lab is a conceptual space in our minds. It's not necessarily a lab, physical lab. So
it's not test tubes.
No, it's not test tubes. We would love to have a space for our tools. But really, it's about making that space conceptually in your mind to allocate time to work on projects mm-hmm. that really question and have a progressive design agenda through that sort of a space. Mm-hmm. And that's really the sort of ethos of our practice.
And what the website also says, the intersection of emerging technologies and everyday life to design for a world in flux. So
yes.
What does that mean?
Websites say big things, don't they? Supposed to. We try really hard to write what we do, and probably gave up sometime last year, because it's really hard to define what we do. And if there's a clever wordsmith out there, I'd love to have a chat. But I think it's not, by flux we mean it in a change, we accept change, and we don't say we want to create change, because that feels too big perhaps, but we accept that there's change and that we are designing for the change. Mm-hmm. And by saying that, we say we accept that there's uncertainty in this world, and we want to design for that uncertainty rather than try and present very certain, definitive answers mm-hmm. to things, because usually that's quite difficult to do anyway.
I also saw the word futurescaping, which I particularly
enjoyed. Yes, I mean, that's just, again, you know, how designers also like to make up words. But I think it kind of, we didn't want to talk about futures. When you say futures, it's really a complicated word. A lot of people say futurology, but that means predictive, mm-hmm. predicting future. So that's a different discipline. We don't believe in predicting futures. Then there's futurism, which is a tradition of doing mm-hmm. futures. There is the idea of, so there's many kind of connotations. By futurescaping, what we're trying to say is a set of techniques mm-hmm. to carve a landscape of many different futures. So we are interested in designing potentiality. We're designing in exploring multiple worlds, which is extremely difficult for companies to understand, because most organizations don't think about one future, let mm-hmm. alone many. So it's a very linear, very short-term thinking. And how do you move that to long-term, multiple views, mm-hmm. Is the idea of futurescaping, really.
I've also seen you in other interviews talk about the idea of, you know, developing new design techniques and methods. Hmm. And another preoccupation of yours, particularly I've seen, is the idea of, you know, the whole maker culture.
Yes.
So how much of an influence has that been on the direction of Superflux?
I think we love and critique maker culture at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we strongly come from a tradition of you must make, but you must also question why you're making what you're making. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to be a very convenient discourse that, look, I've made this, isn't this amazing? I think we need to ask more why you want to make things. So that's one thing. But at the same time, we do design through making. We want to make prototypes. We want to make iterations. We want to be able to make tools that are appropriate for certain contexts. Mm. So we try and use as little post-its in workshops as possible, because then you have a wall of post-its and then you just look at a wall of post-its. And it's kind of, we want to, so it's simple tools that you can design to extract insights from people. Mm-hmm. So from the very basic design of a simple tool to extract ideas and insights to a bit more complex tools that help people think about things. Of course, yeah, absolutely. We love making stuff, yeah.
You've already mentioned that Superflux has the lab idea as well. It's split into two things, a consultancy to deal with clients and the lab to deal with ideas. You've sort of explained why that is, but let's perhaps talk about how those two things interact with each other.
Yeah, I think part of the reason we had to split it quite, because we always used to say this is our work, and then we had to split them because businesses were really worried that they'd come to us and they'd get a fifth-dimensional camera and they'd be like, what do we do with this? How do we sell this? And commissioners would go, okay, so you're just going to do consulting. Like, I think it was done for the world outside to look at how we view these demarcations. Internally, it's quite fluid. We usually have one or two lab projects running through the year and more shorter consultancy projects. But the best thing about it is lab projects give us the opportunity to think about things we don't get to think about, write our own briefs that clients would never come to us with. It helps us to also think about things that we know will help clients think about long-term things or technology, so we are able to stay ahead of the curve in thinking about weak signals and key drivers and trends. But at the same time, consulting work brings rigor because we understand the value of deadlines and time and communication and all of that. So there's a very strong relationship between the two. Yeah.
We're going to move on in a minute to talk about some of those design projects, and I'll just get you to sort of explore what some of them are. Before we do, the other sort of split into two of Superflux is that there's a link between both London and Ahmedabad. There's not, you don't have an office in Ahmedabad, do you, but people.
Yeah.
So there's a link between the two. And again, we'll look at some of the projects that are happening in India when we talk about projects. But before we do that, what's the sort of synergy between those two? What does having people in both places give to the design studio?
I think it sort of gives us the opportunity to think of a wider worldview, isn't it? It gives us an opportunity to understand. So when you talk about smart cities, I'm always thinking of Mumbai, or I'm thinking of Ahmedabad, where I'm from, and I'm thinking, okay, so how do this vision of smart cities actually get implemented in a developed, quote-unquote, developing country? And I think, so having this broader worldview, having a broader perspective, bringing across cross-cultural perspectives into our work, we hope helps us to be a bit more empathic, have a bit more integrity and a bit more sort of a visceral connection to the work we do. So it's not, it's just a bit more of a reflective mode, I think.
You mentioned the fifth dimension camera, which is actually has been on display at City Fictions here at the conference or at the festival. So let's talk about what that is. Tell us what it is and what it was for.
Yeah. So that was actually, we were working with the research department, interaction design, and they were working together with EPSRC. So EPSRC funds a huge amount of science across the country. But one of the things that became part of their remit was to do public engagement to show what they're working on, what the scientists are working on. And we were paired with quantum, well, basically material scientists and quantum physicists from Oxford who are building a quantum computer, really, trying to. We went to their lab, and it's a huge magnet, basically, in the middle of the room with a lot of liquid nitrogen, and I practically lost all my credit cards because I was standing right next to it. not clever, but it is incredible, and some of them are theoretical physicists, and they talk about string theories, and we went there, and we were given 3 months to produce something that people could engage with and understand, and this was meant for science festivals, like the Cheltenham Science Festival and stuff like that. And so we spoke to the physicists, we spoke to David Deutsch, and of course this many worlds theory idea stuck, and it stuck not so much because of there is a lot of dispute about mm-hmm. whether many worlds or parallel worlds exist, but the idea of actually using that metaphor to inverse the quantum computer. Mm-hmm. So basically the idea is that from a single point, many, many worlds split up into many dimensions, mm-hmm. the fifth dimensions as well, and then you can see time from the fifth dimension. And so we thought, what if you could photograph the world from the fifth dimension? What might that look like? And it was essentially to show how a quantum computer will process information in parallel mm-hmm. as opposed to linear computing. And so it'll be, of course, incredibly fast. Mm-hmm. But it will also mean that it will change the way we view reality, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so the fifth dimensional camera raises the questions about what quantum computing or its manifestation will mean to our sense of reality. And so then we presented an artifact and we had to make it extremely tangible. Mm-hmm. We had to make it in a way that kids would suspend disbelief, which they did. And it's great because actually we are so skeptical, and everyone looked at adults would look at it and go like, ha. Like, yeah, whatever. But the kids were like, oh, wow, how do I use it? You know, so it's great. It was a great exercise for us. Next time we'll want a year to work on something like this. But it was great to work on it.
Okay, the next one I want to look at is the wearable badge, the app, which is it's about surveillance and things. Let's tell us what that is and how it works and what that was, the purpose of that was for.
So it's completely opposite. It was a two-week project, literally, and from the idea to the making. And so we had to act really quickly. We were very interested in this whole NSA thing, like everyone. And, you know, one of the things that occurred to us was a couple of things. One was the trigger words, and we wanted to. We'd been looking at them, and it was incredible that if I wrote an email to my parents saying there's a big storm approaching from Southeast England or whatever, and then that'll immediately be an email that the bot, the NSA, or the GCHQ bot will go, hey, there's a storm, word storm in that email. And so it was, we wanted to, what if we were able to extract fragments of our emails and texts and publicly display them? So in a sense, you're not really able to get a full sense of any email or anything. But could that even confuse the bots of the NSA and the GCHQ and other such organizations and, in a sense, make public what is often taken by stealth? And in doing so, we were able to, we could actually get the app and we could build it, and we knew it was possible to build. And so now it's on GitHub. And the idea is that if we were to build it and if we could wear it, what might that mean? But also, in a sense, a lot of wearables are about, like Fitbits and whatever. So you are, it's about information. It's tracking you. It's tracking your information. It's telling you how many steps you walked. Okay. There's a whole thing, guilt associated with that. But what if it was about the world around you? What if it was about the networks around you? And what is our relationship to them? So, in a sense, there were two objectives of the project.
Okay, the next one, which I really loved looking at and reading about, the tarot card reader, which, yes, it has a much different actual implication than that. So tell us what that was.
So that falls into what I might call a tool, like it is a toolkit. And the idea is we were working with synthetic biologists, and a lot of synthetic biologists work on a particular bacterial strain, and they are trying to figure out how you can edit or modify that particular strain so that it might have a different chemical reaction, change color in certain situations and so on. So it's very, very sort of singular research, and naturally kind of they are so involved in it. Our job was to kind of talk more about the wider implications of synthetic biology when it meets economics, politics. And so we created this set of tarot cards. Each tarot card had a certain protagonist, had a certain ear, a certain mission. And so when you play it out, you might be a journalist in Dubai. There is a directive that all patent laws are out and you can just do whatever you want with all the genetic patents, and you had to get rich. That was your mission. So what would you do? And a lot of these scientists found themselves thinking about their own work through the lens of a different protagonist in a different country, in a different circumstance. And I think that brought out very interesting scenarios. So it is basically a scenario generation toolkit, essentially.
And so what was the, again, wider purpose of that?
So the purpose was that this workshop was meant to get synthetic biologists to start talking about their work and interacting with the wider public. Not like in a setting like this, but to work alongside a designer or an economist or a policy writer to see how their work will influence all these things or the vice versa. And so because of these scenarios, then are they going to be able to go out and do that? That is, of course, remains a question. And our objective is that they should be able to think more about it. We have got a few emails, like, you know, people wanting to do this more. The cards are for download and printing, so anyone can reappropriate them. So I think overall it has proved to be useful. We reuse it all the time.
Let's look at a couple of the projects in India.
Yeah.
Then. So the first one, which I just love this title, Design for India's Elastic Cities, which is a great metaphor, I think. So, yeah. So what does that mean?
So this is a sort of response to smart cities in a sense that, you know, here the way our interactions are being designed is that if you go around, you know, like your app has to work and Google Maps must work, and, you know, a lot of people are slightly shy to ask directions because, you know, a lot of, at least, but I know, and, you know, like in India, it couldn't work because you don't have Google Maps just perfectly anyway yet. And I think what I was interested in, the human network, in people as data nodes doing multiple tasks or multiple sort of, so if you're a barber, you're also giving information about the local real estate. If you're an auto rickshaw driver, you're also giving information about the latest Bollywood hits. If you're a pawn seller, you're also giving information about rents or what have you. So, in a sense, the cities are rich with humans as data nodes, and there's a really rich network of information created by these mobile nodes. And how can we really, and is elasticity in that sense, how do we reappropriate this network for this circumstance, and how do we, in that sense, that is a smart city for me, and I don't necessarily need an app sending me horoscopes as but rather I would prefer my rickshaw driver telling me whatever on in this journey. And it's sort of ambient, it's non-traceable, it is temporary, and there's a beauty of that.
So what's the, describe a bit more what the actual design project was then, because that presumably what you're talking about there is it's something that's just, that's just happening.
Yes, right? so in this instance, this project is a research project to map this territory, because it's not been mapped before and it's extremely difficult to map. So in the first instance, we are giving small boxes to rickshaw drivers to carry around them in the rickshaw and map their journeys, and in the process map the interactions and the kind of information exchanges that take place. And in the second instance, subject to funding, we would like to build on that. So we are trying to map the blueprint of such information networks in Indian cities, and then build services or additional services or smartness, what have you, on top of that.
So what sort of things do you envision?
Contest specific. I think they will be more governed by the people themselves. So it's a, which is also interesting because there are such few laws around like informal structures. You, if you pay a bit of bribe to the policeman, you can open your little barber shop around the corner for 6 months, then his boss might see and you go, might go somewhere else. So there's such a lot of autonomy because of the loopholes in the laws. We want to also try and build on that.
The other project then is concerned with desertification.
Yeah, that's Leeloran. That's really, that's been a really difficult one because what we wanted to do was to create toolkits with the local community, because desertification is going to be one of the biggest problems in Gujarat, where I come from. Half of it is a desert. The poorest communities who live in the desert are going to be the most affected by climate change. They're already experiencing harsh and extreme changes in weather. And so we wanted to design toolkits that will help them, work with them, to bring expertise or knowledge of other regions around the world, like permaculturalists who have done extremely good work in the Sahara deserts and stuff, to the space to recreate them. What has happened is that we've gone there, we've established conversations, we've established a great team. There are a lot of people who are really interested in joining the thing, but there's a politics. So there is a certain group of people who don't want that to happen. There is a certain group of people who feel we are taking ownership of something that they want. So we've got entangled, actually, from a distance, in a sort of a political limbo, if you like, where we don't know how we can progress this project, which is great because, in a way, it points to the actual ground-level problems that exist when you want to try and do such a project, you know. It has to come from the people, but the people who want to do it are absolutely powerless. So it's kind of,
And again, it points to the, you know, the flexibility of the company, the design consultancy, that you can, you know, operate in both these areas, an area of that sort of heavy bureaucracy, and also one where there's just all of that just amazing constant innovation going on.
Yes.
One more of these. We're actually talking about, I should have said, we're talking about ideas that come out of the labs here, first of all. And I want to look at a couple of the consultancy work ones. But the last one of the lab ones is this Arc Ink.
Yeah.
Which is like a sort of a visualization of a sort of post-crash society. So let's talk about where that came from. Where did that come out of?
John's degree show project at the RCA. And this was 2006, before the climate change denial and the climate change issues became so much covered by the press. And he imagined a service design project called Arcing Designs for a Post-Crash Civilization. And essentially the idea is that let's imagine that the collapse has happened. Let's imagine that it has crashed. And so what things will get value? What things will... So he designed a series of products. He also designed the Paradigm Index, which showed how these products, as the crash gets bigger or becomes worse, how these products that you've invested in, because in anticipation of the crash, start getting more value. So he created a stock exchange, if you like, for this post-crash world and the kind of things that will have value and those which will decrease in value post-crash. He also designed a radio, which was a normal radio, and then you could break the glass and it became a shortwave radio, and it had a key, and it also had a solar-powered battery, and so it became a product with a different purpose. And a series of books which helped people initiate them into this post-crash world. And he created the website. And until date, we receive emails from people who want to, because the part of Arc Inc. was that you become a member of the Arc Inc. collective, and you can start your own collectives across the world. So we get people who are emailing saying they want to become part of the Arc Inc. members, they want to become part of the collective, especially a lot from the post-Hurricane Katrina world, and saying that I have experienced the crash, it's happened, I want to join ARC, I want to live in this other world, I do. And it is, that is the tension of this kind of work. What are the legal and ethical boundaries? At which point you as a designer can't take it any further, even though you want to build it. You can't build a real thing because it is problematic. And it's extremely difficult. It's been difficult for John to kind of understand, because people with real problems, so of course they can start similar collectives, but actually it's a deeper question about ethics and legality.
How have you dealt with that?
We have, so obviously to each person we will write and saying that, you know, this was a thought experiment, but we very much want to understand your current situation. But we are not counsellors as well, are we really? So in a sense, how far do these thought experiments, and that's ethics of design fiction is something we are really working on. We even think that there should be a little, like a watermark or a logo or something which says that, you know, this is, but at the same time you want people to suspend disbelief, which a lot of people did and understood the project. So it's we are working with it. We are trying to understand what's the best fidelity of an idea that is slick enough but not too slick.
Though it's a thought experiment, and as you mentioned, you know, obviously in the real world you can't really build these things, but because of that interaction with people who are actually experiencing those things in the real world, some things could come out of it, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, our also, to be honest, from Arc Inc., and then we did the Power of Eight project, which was bringing together different people with different interests to think about optimistic visions of the future around climate change. And so that was one outcome. From Power of Eight, Tessie went on and wrote a book about the community, as different communities that she's working in. Charlie went and started working with foraging and collecting all the sort of fruit that was being wasted and started creating apple. Like, he kind of wanted to do real action. We started Lilo Run because of that project. So there are lots of connections to the kind of thinking, like how can we actually have impact change, but how can we still continue this critical conversation, I think. So there is a thread. It's just loose.
You just mentioned the Power of Eight idea, which is the thing that you took part in. So perhaps... elucidate on that a bit, because that's a really powerful idea.
Yeah, so that was, in a sense, it is about, you know, there's dystopia and then actually, or utopia, but actually the kind of real world optimism for the future. How do you share it? Do you have it? Is there a collective view of the future? And the different people came together. It was extremely difficult in those 3 months for 8 people who've never met each other, who've never worked with each other, who are not designers, who don't understand the design process, to agree on a vision of a future. Because simple things that I want the Taiwanese noodle shop in my street and I don't. And so the process of co-creating democratic futures is hard, but it should be done and has to be done. And the process of DIY futures and making futures as we go along is hard and should be done. And a lot of things that came out of the futures, like Charlie said, not all of us agreed with everything, but there's a part of us in this vision of the future. And it was troubling And there's some troubling bits and there are some happy bits. And that's exactly what the future is going to be like, messy mm-hmm. and complicated, whichever future we become part mm-hmm. of. So I think it was not so much about the future as about the present, actually. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing, that actually a lot of our work is about the present, mm-hmm. which is something why Catherine Hales is a big influence, yeah. because what she's saying is all this thinking about the future is about how it helps us think about the present. Mm-hmm. Because in a sense, when you think about long-term stuff, you are wanting to extrapolate that to see how that is going to influence our present and mm-hmm. how we can then move in different directions. So I think that's quite core, actually.
And some of her concerns, I mean, you do see cropping up throughout your work. So things like, you know, transhumanism.
Exactly.
Like, you know, the issues around DNA testing, for instance.
Yeah.
So I watched the video on YouTube of you talking in the Design in the Future lecture that you did, and all of these concerns sort of yeah. come up. So let's perhaps talk about the, you know, we don't know the future, obviously, we don't yeah. know what the future's going to be like. So,
yeah.
but we know it's probably going to be messy, but some of those concerns, as I said, crop up throughout your work.
Yes, they do. And I don't know, like, there's all sorts of different conversations to be had. Like, a lot of people say, why do you bother about the future? You know, it's about the now, we've got to sort out our now. To everybody who has a child, I just say, really? Like, my son is 2 and he's going to be 20. And if you look at any climate science statistics, it's a scary world. If we look at the neutral scientific facts. And so how can we not think about the future? How can we not think about these questions? And how can we not try and, in whatever small powers we have, try and create a public conversation around it? And doing these talks, being part of these festivals, is our only perhaps current channel. Mm-hmm. Ideally, we would like to sit alongside policymakers, we would like to sit alongside politicians and economists to actually think about how we can extrapolate some of these ideas and these questions into real-world influence.
I just want to talk about one more thing, which is one of the projects that's come out of the consultancy side of your work in a number of ways, and that's this idea of the Internet of Things, which again is just, it's a lovely idea. So tell us, explain to us what that is, and then we can talk about what work
I think for the Internet, in terms of Internet of Things, 2 things interest me. One is when objects start becoming smart, like really smart, so autonomous with a sense of agency, because we want them to do that. But what happens when they start becoming even ever so slightly smart? So that's one area I'm really interested in, the emotional side of things, mm-hmm. of objects, the emotions of objects. And the other side is the big thing, the idea of big data, you know, big data, lots of data, let's make all data public. But actually, how can you and I even begin to understand what that data means? Mm. How can we actually use it in any meaningful way in our everyday lives? And so Internet of Things Academy, or IOTA, is about exploring how we can move from data spectatorship to ways in which people can actually think with that data mm-hmm. and use it meaningfully. How public can make their own data, not make public the data, but mm-hmm. how public make their own data, build their own hypothesis, and use that hypothesis to create change in their own lives. So that's really our interest. It has a specific social agenda. We are interested in complex societal problems, especially around the environment, mm-hmm. and if at all, where the Internet of Things can tackle them. So, yeah.
Okay, I think that's a good point for us to end. So
cool.
We'll wrap
Great.
It up. Then. We're
you.
A little bit early, but
That's
it is
fine.
The last session, so you're allowed to go home early. It's cool. The last day of the,
thank you. Cheers
the
very
session.
Much.
So yes, Anna, thank you. Everybody.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.